SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yaman, welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandami Ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandami. Coming up in your program this Wednesday, the 28th of August, have an interview of Matudunera traditional owner Peter Cooper talking about the recent transfer of West Intercourse Island in the Dampier Archipelago in Western Australia to traditional owners. So in the program, we have an interview of Dr. John Farrer talking about breakthroughs and successes in reversing cataracts and improvements in eye treatment in First Nations patients. Also, on NITV Radio today, we explore subscription traps. As many of you may know, it's extremely easy to sign up for anything online, but getting out of no longer wanted subscriptions can be a daunting exercise. All these stories and more coming to you after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
This bulletin, Indigenous experts gather in Darwin for landmark land and water management forum. The Prime Minister says Australia has secured support for the Pacific Policing Initiative. And Sudan's war marks 500 days of conflict, a conflict that's prompted the world's largest food crisis. People from across the country have converged on Darwin for the First Nations Land and Water Management Conference. The conference began with Larrakia Saltwater Welcome Ceremony, where delegates shared their essence with the sea. More than 600 water managers will spend the next 2 days sharing and showcasing their achievements looking after country. With water reserves under pressure from agriculture, mining and climate change, the forum will focus on strengthening land and water management through culture, new technology and future planning. Minister for Indigenous Australians Malandiri McCarthy says safeguarding the local environment benefits everyone.
This forum also provides an important opportunity to hear from Indigenous land managers about their work so stronger programs can be developed leading to better outcomes for country. Caring for country is also an important way to achieve cultural, social, environmental and economic benefits. Caring for country provides valuable work and income that supports families and communities.
A 12-year-long fight for native title in Western New South Wales has at long last been recognised by the Federal Court. The determination was handed down in an open-air Federal Court ceremony on country in Cobar. The ruling covers more than 95,000 square kilometres and recognises the native title rights of Nyemba, Nyampa, Wangapuna and Wailuan peoples. The non-exclusive native title includes rights to access the land, hunt, fish and gather resources as well as engage in cultural activities. The Federal Opposition spokesperson for Indigenous Australians has again raised calls for a government inquiry into the effectiveness of Indigenous land councils. Coalition Senator Jacinta Nampinjipa-Price and several Arandi elders have argued that poor governance and a lack of accountability has led to traditional owners feeling their views are not represented by the councils. Federal MP for the NT division of Lingiari, Marion Scrimger, has previously claimed that Senator Price was fueled by a so-called personal vendetta against land councils, arguing the bodies are already under immense scrutiny. But Ms. Price says the government needs to heed her calls for more transparency.
There is a lot of concern around the lack of accountability, the lack of transparency with the way in which land councils are being governed in this country, and particularly the concerns that have been brought to me by traditional owners with regard to the Central Land Council. There has been allegations of bullying, intimidation, misconduct. Traditional owners do not feel like they're being heard. There is now an appetite for groups to want to have their own land councils.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says Australia has secured support for the Pacific Policing Initiative. The Pacific Policing Initiative will establish a multinational force which would be drawn from across the Pacific Islands and based in northern Australia and establish training centres of excellence across the Pacific. Australia will commit approximately $400 million over 5 years to the initiative. Mr. Albanese says the initiative was a priority for Australia heading into the Pacific Island Forum.
This is something that has arisen from the Pacific family to look after the Pacific family ourselves. Our Pacific neighbours stand with each other and we help each other in times of need. And it is good that this morning we endorse the Pacific Policing Initiative.
And Australia and Tuvalu are expected to announce later today that the Falapeli Union Treaty has entered into force on the sidelines of the Pacific Island Forum Leaders Meeting in Tonga. Under the agreement, Australia will offer up to 280 visas to Tuvaluans each year to build lives in Australia, fund climate adaptation and develop projects. Tuvalu's Prime Minister Feleti Teo says it's a groundbreaking arrangement. The pact was announced at last year's Pacific Islands Forum meeting in November 2023 in the Cook Islands. It has been 500 days since the start of the conflict in Sudan that has plunged the African nation into the world's biggest food crisis. The war between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces began in the nation's capital of Khartoum and rapidly spread out through the entire nation. Data from the United Nations shows over 10 million people have been displaced due to the ongoing conflict that has led thousands of people dead, destroying critical infrastructure in the country. Speaking to SBS, Médecins Sans Frontières Emergency Coordinator to Port Sudan, Esperanza Santos, says the situation is critical.
And now what we are seeing is that the food security, like clean access to clean water, access to basic services as health, are a challenge for many of the population in Sudan. In some areas, especially like food insecurity and malnutrition, are reaching very high levels.
Ukraine's top general, Oleksandr Sirsky, says Ukraine has captured 100 settlements during its three-week-long incursion in Russia's Kursk region. He says 494 Russian servicemen were also captured during the operation. Meanwhile, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency has visited a nuclear power plant in Kursk. Rafael Grossi says there is a risk of nuclear incident over nuclear incident due to the fighting in the area.
The core of the reactor containing nuclear material is protected just by a normal roof. This makes it extremely exposed and fragile, for example, to an artillery impact or a drone or a missile.
Back home, supermarket giant Woolworths has announced its commitment to net zero deforestation by 2025 as its annual report was released today. The report states that by December 31st, 2025, Woolworths will source high-risk commodities, which includes products such as beef, paper, cocoa and coffee from net zero deforestation supply chains. Senior campaigner at Greenpeace Australia Pacific, Gemma Plasman, told SBS that the environmental advocacy group welcomes the news, particularly as 100 million native animals are killed or injured every year from deforestation alone. Ms. Plasman says the target aligns with the global science-based targets, which sets targets to reduce emissions in its supply chain.
The number one driver of deforestation is beef production, and supermarkets like Woolies are some of the biggest beef buyers in Australia. So with a strong implementation plan for this very strong commitment, Woolworths can make a considerable difference in helping the destruction of our forests, helping to end the destruction of our forests, and also the associated emissions from deforestation, which are significant.
Woolworths initiative follows Aldi's move earlier this year to roll out the destruction of all ecosystems, including native bushland. And Australia's southeast is being battered by strong and damaging winds with gusts of up to 130 kilometres an hour. ACS Victoria's Chief Officer of Operations, Wibush Tim, has told Channel 9 there have already been 500 requests for assistance. And on a lighter note, Paloa Mann from Lotrita has become the first Indigenous Australian to win the Mr. Universe International Beauty Pageant. John Berry was crowned Mr. Universe at the contest that took place in India on Sunday night. No stranger to the stage, the model, actor and comedian has represented the country before at the 2019 Mr. World contest. The Mr. Universe competition is not without controversy, as Johnny was banned from wearing the Aboriginal flag due to copyright issues. And to sport in football, Mary Fowler says she feels disappointed for the way things went for the Matildas at the Paris Olympics. The Tillies were eliminated in group stage with just one win and two losses following matches against Germany, Zambia and the United States. The elimination led to the resignation of team manager Tony Gustafsson, with Football Australia currently in the process of searching for his replacement. Speaking to Channel 10 ahead of a friendly football tournament in Perth with her club Manchester City, Fowler says her and her teammates wanted to do more at the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's hard looking back at the Olympics not to feel disappointed with, you know, the results from that. You know, it's obviously like a very proud moment being there, you know, second time round. Like, I was really grateful for that experience, so definitely still trying to take positives from it as well. I think it is hard, you know, when you don't succeed in the way that you wanted to.
Now, having a look at the weather around the country: Broome, a sunny day, 38 degrees. Perth, partly cloudy, 21. Adelaide, a shower, 2, 17. Melbourne, similar conditions, 18. Hobart, showers easing and 12 degrees. Albury, Wodonga, light rain, 16. Canberra, partly cloudy, 18. Wollongong, sunny, a top of 25. Sydney, mostly sunny, 28. Newcastle, also sunny, 29. Brisbane, similar conditions, 31 degrees. And Townsville, mostly cloudy, 27. Cairns, a shower or 2, 28. Alice Springs, a sunny and a top of 34. Darwin, same forecast with 34 degrees as well. And the Torres Strait Islands, a sunny day ahead and a top of 31 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
TV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
We come from the land down under. Can you see, can you feel the wonder? Bookmark Malawangan, living under one sun.
And that was King Ray's interpretation of Men at Work's Down Under. I really like the sound of the Yidaki. That adds something special. It really gives a touch and feel of a country. I'm Bertrand Tungandami, and you're listening to NITV Radio, coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Wednesday afternoon. Coming up next, we have an interview of Dr. John Farah talking about breakthroughs and successes in reversing cataract and also in eye treatment for First Nations patients. Also in the program today, we explore subscription traps. As many of you have experienced, it's extremely easy to sign up for anything, be it for magazines or apps or anything online, but getting out of no longer wanted subscriptions can be a daunting exercise. But first, West Intercourse Island in the Dampier Archipelago in WA was recently transferred to traditional owners. To explore the significance of this development, I caught up with our Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation traditional owner with great insights into the event. The WA government will transfer West Intercourse Island to the traditional owners and custodians. And to discuss this, I'm joined by Peter Cooper from the Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation, Acting Rangers Manager. This is a significant development. Just run us through how this came about.
I think back in the 70s when Burke was premier, and what happened was that island was going to be built for a industry, like a port system out there. Apparently, it didn't go well through at that time. So now they decided to give us back the island, back to MAC as a natural reserve, so we can look after it, protect it, and especially the animals and the rock art that's out there is really significant to us. And all of the Ngarrindjeri is all the five language groups.
Yeah, this is a big block of land that's being transferred to Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation, a corporation that's been really working hard to protect and preserve the cultural heritage of the area. As a rangers manager, as someone really active in the community, how significant is this for the organization and the community?
It's really good for us. It comes under us, like, good for the charters to look after. And there's five big islands, especially West Intercourse, that's going to be a safe haven. So, like, and jointly managed with DBCA with us rangers too, to look after these big islands, because our main goal is to put these islands as sanctuaries for endangered animals.
Yeah,
like all the sort of stuff. Because let's say our biggest threat probably comes from the north, probably will be the Cantones, but at least these big islands will be a sanctuary for especially the northern quoll or the pilbara olive pythons, to the fear of them eating these creatures and dying is going to be massively for us, especially because of what we've got, especially animals around here. But these islands play a big role in our way of looking after it. And West Intercourse is one of the islands that there's a lot of history on it, so you know there's a big mountain of shells where they've been eaten, and there's all rock art. There's thousands and thousands of rock art, not only in West Intercourse, but also the big islands. And every island you look at is the rock art everywhere. But our main concern is here, like, just to preserve animals and look after the nature of these big islands. Because like I say, we're so glad they came back to us. Because like I say, you give us more power, more protection to look after these big islands.
You just mentioned the animals. There are also shell maidens and rock art, standing stones. And especially, it's evidence of a continuous occupation of thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
Exactly. If you go by a helicopter and look at that island, you know, there's estuaries, there's marshlands, there's wetlands, there's everything that's around there tells you that this is a good place to get a feed. You know, not only yourself, but you know, your whole tribe or your family, things like that you can live off. You know, back then, you know, you see a mountain of shells, you think, you know, that's what was really healthy for us, in a way that, you know, we still eat it to this day, but back then was the staple diet was a lot of shells. So it tells us a history that, you know, these ancestors, you know, were very healthy people, you know.
It's so significant, actually. The area has been nominated for World Heritage listing.
Yeah, and I think it's good too, because like I said, that comes under us now, and that's included in West Intercourse now. So, like I said, there's three places that were built for industry. One was Legenda Island, but that's came back to us. There's going to be a port there, but that's also came back to us a few years back. And site Alanis across Woodside, that's built industry, but that came back to us. And now we got West Intercourse, that's one of the big islands, but now it came back to us to look after. Really important for us to get it back, but it'll stop industry from, going a bit further in their processes.
It said that the area will be under joint management between traditional owners and the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions. What role will each of the two partners play in managing the place?
The part is really, really important. If it comes to the village or national park in that way,
we
work so closely with DBCA, Department of Biodiversity, but the thing is, we're a good relationship and they like to do our sea patrols and work together, especially our sea patrols and looking up and plus cleaning up the islands, you know what I mean? So like a lot of debris comes on the islands, we go there and clean up with them and together we jointly manage it. So it's a good partnership, but like I said, we work together to help each other. And that's our role is to look after what's out there and same with DBCA. We work together jointly, but to do the same things as we do, to look after our country.
Now that handing over these to traditional owner management, jointly with, of course, the Department of Biodiversity, and it means that the industrial activities will not be carried out on the area. What else can be done now? Are there any economic and tourism opportunities that are opening up thanks to these?
There are plans to probably use West Lewis as an example. West Intercourse, sorry, for example, that one day people can camp on these islands, but we tell them that you can camp there, but just on the shoreline, you don't go 100 meters back from it on the land itself. So there's boundaries, and that's what we've got to protect. We do our patrols in that, so people are doing that wrong thing. We can tell them to come down or get off the island and something, because like I said, there's signs there going to be. In future plans, there's going to be camping grounds on there, but it'll be managed by the rangers and DBCA, like jointly managed, but it'll be good in the way that we can control this, but also manage those situations that does come. Like I said, there will be some hiking trails on these areas, but it's our job to go out there first and look at these areas where it's men's or women's sites.
Yeah.
But to make it culturally safe, we're going to look at these things that if we do ever come up with West Intercourse or NDB or any islands, our job is to look at that area first, what they want to do.
Before I let you go, what else can you tell us about this development, its significance for your people and the future projects besides maybe what you just mentioned?
It gives us a big sense of pride. Like I said, it's something that people don't realize that, this we get the barb is really huge in that way that, we got priceless things like, rock art that's 50,000 to 60,000 years old. And there's evidence of, our ancestors, they put in these rock art petroglyphs. And you can see that, you see areas where there's, where there's standing stones and all that sort of stuff that leads you to fresh water or things like that, because it's a big eye opener for us. But in a way that to protect it gets back to us, I think most people I talk to now are very, very proud of what happened yesterday.
Peter Cooper of the Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today about this new development, the transfer of West Intercourse Island into the Dampier Archipelago Islands Reserve Network to the traditional owners and custodians.
No, thank you. I appreciate that.
And that was Peter Cooper of the Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation. Now, if you missed this conversation, you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. We must now step aside, but stay with us, because when we come back, we have a conversation with Dr. John Farah. Dr. John Farah will be talking to us about the latest development in eye health. As you may know, First Nations people are more likely to suffer serious sight deterioration at an earlier age than non-Indigenous Australians. However, as Dr. John Farah tells us, in many cases, this fate can be reversed. A cataract surgery can restore sight in even near-blind patients. To learn more about this, stay tuned.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
Hello, Dector, and welcome.
Hi, Saaka. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for joining us. Doctor, can we please first have a look at what the situation is? So we know that Indigenous Australians are more likely to suffer eye or sight deterioration. So why is that?
Well, Saaka, yeah, that's true. They're six times more likely, in fact, to have visual impairment than non-Indigenous Australians, which is a shocking figure. Mm. I mean, there's some evidence that in recent times the trend is reducing and the multiple is not quite as high as six times, but a study in 2016 showed that it was six times more likely for visual impairment to be experienced by Indigenous Australians than non-Indigenous Australians. And of that, probably 90% is actually treatable and or preventable. And 30% or 32% is the exact figure is actually due to is cataract blindness. Mm. And there are a multitude of reasons, one of which is the comorbidities in the Indigenous population. So diabetes being, as you know, very, very, very common in the Indigenous population and not always treated vigorously or oftentimes that goes undiagnosed, in fact. And then diabetes itself, it leads to premature cataract formation. And that's probably the biggest single reason, but there's a host of other reasons as well. A lot of the other causes, apart from just cataracts, which is my main focus with these patients, but a lot of other causes as well are treatable and preventable. We're talking about the adult population.
This is pretty shocking. The numbers are very high. As you said, it's preventable. So your focus is the cataract surgery. What exactly is cataract?
The eye has got a lens inside of it, and that lens has to stay clear in order for us to see, because light comes through, first of all, the cornea, and it's focused partly by the cornea, and then it travels through the eye and it comes to the lens, and at that point it's focused again and it's focused onto the retina, allowing us to see. And when that lens becomes cloudy so that the light can't get through it, people are varying degrees of blind, all the way to only being able to see light and dark. And in extreme cases, if the lens becomes very, very, very dense, then they can't even tell that. So it's a debilitating condition. But the thing about it is we have the technology and the techniques to take out that lens, which is cloudy, and we can replace it with a clear lens that will focus the light onto the retina and let people see again. And that lens is made of usually acrylic, sometimes silicon. It's a very treatable, probably the most treatable blinding condition that we have. And no one should be blind from cataracts in Australia, no one.
Mm. How difficult this surgery is?
So the surgery ranges in difficulty. So in a case where the person's got mild or moderate cataracts, the surgery is very straightforward, with a complication rate less than 1 in 2,000. So it's very, very safe and relatively straightforward. When the cataracts become increasingly dense or there are other comorbidities such as glaucoma or some of the structures in the eye are weaker than expected or there's other damage there, then the cataract surgery becomes much more complex as you try and remove. Some of these cataracts we're taking out are hard like rocks or granite, and they take a lot of energy has to go into the eye to remove it. The operating time is a lot longer, and then the new lens that you put in the eye, it has to sit where the old lens used to be. And sometimes because there are other diseases in the eye, that position in the eye is compromised, and you've got to find creative ways to put the new lens in. Sometimes you've got to sew a lens in, or you have to clip it in or rest it in a different position than you'd planned. Still works out just fine, but it just means the operating time and the complexity is sometimes orders of magnitude higher, where it's a harder operation than if you're just doing a straightforward mild or moderate cataract. So the longer the people wait to get their cataracts done, then the more difficult the surgery becomes, with more risk and more operating time and longer recoveries and stuff, which is why it's important to treat people as soon as there's some disability from the cataract. They should really be treated. But a lot of our First Nations people have cataracts which are on the severe or very severe end of the spectrum.
So what are the obstacles? Why aren't people getting the help they need? Is the question of the cost?
That's a factor for sure. I think one thing is an awareness that the disease is prevalent. So an awareness of the fact that if something starts to go wrong, you need to seek help promptly. And the sooner you seek help, then the more quickly it can be fixed. Cost is a barrier. And if cost is a barrier, then, of course, we have a public system in Australia. But the waiting periods can be extensive because so many people are trying to access the services. So the waiting times can be so long that the disease, which was, say, moderate, becomes severe by the time they come to be treated. And then other problems rear their head as well. With cataracts, people often are known to have a higher incidence of falling, for example, and fracturing bones and hips and things. So while they're waiting, other things, and in many, many cases, other events have occurred, and then that's put the whole thing back even further while we're getting that fixed up. That we see that quite frequently. But with IUE, so IUIH, they actually have fabulous optometry services as well, which the Indigenous people can access more easily. And they're being screened for these vision problems, and then treatment can be arranged for them in a much more timely fashion. So that's why it's a fantastic partnership with the IUE or IUIH unit doing the optometrical screening and then liaising with us and with the MATA, and we can get them in for surgery when it's needed. So it's fabulous. We'll coordinate it all, and we'll do it all in the same year. IUE coordinate transport to and from the operating room to the MATA hospital. And when they're there, we have lots of support staff walking them through all the stages. We do a list with 30 Indigenous patients on it, and they actually can also be support for themselves. You know, there's a lot of camaraderie in the waiting room, and it's not so scary that way. So the compliance is better. You have a cataract operation, particularly in complex eyes, follow-up's just as important as the operation itself. And traditionally, that's been a bit of a problem, arranging great follow-up and compliance with drop routine and compliance with appointments. With the support of IUE and the MATA and the fellow patients going through it as well, that's been fantastic. Compliance with follow-up has been second to none. It's been really good, big part of it.
That's great results and great support for people who are suffering with this condition. So what would be the next steps to improve the situation for First Nations patients with this problem?
I think even further outreach into some regions which aren't serviced by IUIH, and there are some programs, and they can take the form of optometrists or ophthalmologists or both, the team going out further into the communities and actively screening and educating, and just letting everyone know that if you think there might be a problem, it's best to get it looked at, because if you get it early on, it's really easily fixed. 90%, more than 90% of the problems can be fixed. Myself and Dr. Warrior, we're the two doctors that have been doing it, have actually found it a big privilege to be doing this surgery. And hopefully the program will continue, and actually, as well as outreach, I should say, the other thing is that more of it is needed still, because we still have some backlog we're not getting through. So it's a privilege to be involved with it. It's just fantastic for us. It's very, very gratifying to see people's whole lives transformed. And so we want the program to keep going and to get bigger and get more patients in, perhaps in maybe even in an earlier stage where their disease isn't quite so advanced. That could be the future as well.
And that was Dr. John Farah talking to us about cataract surgeries, what they are, how they help, how much they cost, and also about a project that helped
more than 1,000 First Nations Australians to undergo the surgery and change their lives by restoring their sight. Thank you so much for talking to us, Doctor.
It's a pleasure, Saka. Thanks for talking to me.
That was Dr. John Farah talking to NITV Radio's Sharka Pekova. Now, if you missed this conversation or you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. We must step aside for another break, but stay tuned because when we come back, we'll look at subscription traps. You may be aware, getting to a subscription on anything online is very, very easy. It takes a few seconds, but getting out of an unwanted subscription can be a daunting exercise, sometimes even a nightmare. Make sure you get the full picture, not just what the social media feed gives you. Find all our news and stories at SBS Language website. Bookmark sbs.com.au/language in your web browser today.
Hey guys, Jackie White here, proud Wiradjuri man. You're listening to NITV Radio. Let's go.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio, coming to you from Naam on the Kulin Nation this Wednesday afternoon. Now, Australians are confronting so-called subscription traps, with 3/4 revealing to have had some form of negative experience trying to cancel a subscription. A report by the Consumer Policy Research Centre also found 3% of Australians have felt pressured into keeping a subscription they wanted to cancel, and that Australia's consumer laws are falling behind other countries. Katrina Stierart reports.
Many of us have a subscription we fought to cancel, or have even given up trying after countless attempts. It turns out this experience is more common than some might expect, with a new report highlighting that 75% of Australians have had some form of negative experience when trying to cancel a subscription. A report by the Consumer Policy Research Centre has found that while subscribing can take a matter of seconds, cancelling a subscription often takes far longer. And nearly half of Australians have spent more time than intended trying to cancel a subscription. Chandni Gupta is Deputy Chief Executive and Digital Policy Director at the Consumer Policy Research Centre.
What we've found is that subscription traps are costing people time, money, and ultimately their peace of mind. So we currently live in a digital economy where we own nothing and we subscribe to everything. And so it's such a shame to see, but it's not surprising that people are having trouble cancelling out of services they no longer need or want.
So what methods are businesses using to make it difficult for consumers to unsubscribe? Ms. Gupta explains.
What we saw is that companies are using multiple complex screens. They're using a feature called dark patterns, which basically is features that are added into websites and apps to make it really difficult for people to navigate their own choice. Often it's steering them into a choice that's profitable for the business, but ultimately not in the best interest of the consumer. And what that leads to is that you're not able to implement the choice that you've actually made when you say, I want out.
Professor Luke Nottage from Sydney University's Business Law School is an expert in consumer law, but even he is not immune to these subscription traps. He took out a year-long subscription to The Economist magazine, which was discounted to half price, and which he said took only 30 seconds to sign up to. But when Professor Nottage went to cancel his subscription, he was met with obstacles.
Eventually you get to a web page on The Economist magazine where it says, oh, you can't do it online. You have to ring up and speak to someone in these business hours. And eventually you get through to someone who, tries to say, well, please don't, are you sure you want to cancel your subscription? And you know, maybe we can do a deal. And, you know, it's like, no, I just want to cancel it.
He was eventually able to cancel the subscription, but only after several days of trying. Professor Nottage said he contacted the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission which initially replied to say they had lodged their complaint, and after a follow-up email directed Professor Nottage to reach out to their state regulator. The ACCC said in a statement to SBS that they have been advocating for some time for an unfair trading practices prohibition, and in 2023 made a submission to the federal government's consultation calling for this prohibition to be introduced. They added that businesses that operate a subscription trap business model may breach the Australian consumer law within the unfair contract term. Professor Nottage says current Australian law doesn't allow for the arguably unfair practices that businesses' subscription services can sometimes adopt. Current laws have prohibitions on misleading conduct, where you must prove a consumer has been misled, or on unconscionable conduct in trade, which relies on laws proving a business has taken advantage of someone's vulnerability. Professor Nottage says the Federal Treasury commenced a review of the Australian Consumer Law in 2017, but specific changes around these subscription practices are yet to be enforced.
I think we can't really obviously push a lot further down the line of misleading conduct or unconscionable conduct. And that's why they were looking in particular in some sort of broader unfair commercial practices or unfair trading prohibition, which would sit, if you like, even above the misleading and unconscionable conduct prohibition. And the model for this, which would be a new amendment to the Australian Consumer Law, which would be enacted by the federal government, then mirrored in the state legislation that harmonises consumer law across Australia.
Ms. Gupta agrees that Australia's consumer protection laws have limitations. In fact, their report also found that 1 in 10 Australians give up trying to cancel their subscription altogether, continuing to pay for unwanted services. She would like to see laws in place that regulators would be able to enforce, such as those seen in the United States or under the European Union.
In Australia, we have strong consumer protection laws, but what it covers us for is businesses can't lie to us and businesses can't do something extremely egregious. But there isn't really anything protecting us from somewhere in the middle. So those unfair practices are where the loophole is, and what you have now is a situation where you could be using the same service, the same platform run by the same business, but someone in Brussels has better protection than someone sitting in Brisbane.
As well as calling on the government to introduce an unfair trading prohibition before the next federal election, the report also calls upon banks to work with businesses to better protect customers from these subscription tactics.
What we'd really like to see is banks and businesses working together where you could look up your subscriptions through a bank transaction, and when you see there is one, you'd be able to cancel it straight from there. It's a way to make it as seamless as possible as it is to join and to leave.
Katrina Sterrett, SBS News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
And that was Because by Jess Mowboy. And with that song, that's all we have from us on NITV Radio for you today. Your program will be back with more news and stories from right across the country on Friday afternoon. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for your company this Wednesday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now.